Hello and welcome back to the Dune Minute Podcast, your place to dive deep, minute by minute, into the cinematic adaptation of Frank Herbert's World of Dune. I am one of your hosts, Zach.
And I'm John.
And we are back. Happy Tuesday, John. My mind just went completely blank, man.
Talking about minute 56 through 57.
Yeah, well, I even have notes right in front of me, and my mind just went completely blank. Thank you. Yes, we are talking about minute 56 through 57 today. I hope everyone out there is having a good one, and I think this is going to be a relatively short one for us, unless you have more supplemental material.
I've got tons. So.
Okay, fair enough. All right. Well, this might be an art and soul heavy episode. Because
this is an art and soul heavy week, because yeah. While this is a very high octane, high action week of Dune Part 2, at least for these first three episodes, there's not a whole lot of dialogue to talk about.
Right. And we almost get a wordless minute here.
Almost.
Almost a wordless minute.
Yeah.
So let's dive into it, man. We open this minute up with some more close-ups of Hole.
Of Harry Hole.
Yes. Brazilian waxes have not been introduced to Arrakis yet. So
at least not to Shai Hulud.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah.
So, yes, we get a close-up of Hole. We can see the hairs inside of them. And
God damn it.
Paul he's really struggling on this worm as it's like rotating around. He's got both hooks anchored in,
yep.
But he's almost in like a Jesus Christ on the cross stance,
mm-hmm.
With the hooks. One's behind him, one's in front of him. So he can't really do a whole lot with that.
He's just kind of hanging for dear life.
Yeah. What's that Lighthouse song? Hanging by a Moment? Here with you. Anyways.
Hanging by a Moment with Shai Hulud.
There you go. Hey, perfect. Awesome. So... He removes the hook on his left hand, which is the downwind hook, I guess you would call it. And
I guess that's the best way to describe it.
Yeah, it's the one that's behind him in the traveling direction of the worm, and like swings it around to where they're both attached forward, mm-hmm. of Paul. And we get to see, it latch on and pulls up, and we hear another growl, and we see more Hole. And
this is when Paul, like, really begins to take control,
yeah.
of Shai Hulud.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
we see him, you know, kind of hoisting all of his weight towards one side, which in turn is causing the worm to turn more and more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the sun is really starting to become, you know, exposed again as Paul is really nearing the top of the worm.
Right.
But he's still questionably
he's a little shaky still.
Yeah.
He's not fully on his feet. He's kind of on his knees at this point.
Yeah.
And the worm just like blasts through another dune, and Paul catches this right to the face.
Yeah. Yeah. It's once again, another, you know, moment of quiet respite. Okay. Maybe I've got control. Fuck you. No, you don't. Here's a wall of sand that you're going to hit going at 50 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And so much so that it like kind of muffles all of the sound that we hear as mm-hmm. well.
Yep.
You know, it's that very like stereotypical concussed, you know, sound effect that they want to do where all the highs get cut out of the audio and everything, and it's just all you hear is the low, like, kind of yeah. like rumbles, and kind of like in war movies when someone gets blasted with a grenade and someone's like yelling at them, but all you hear mm-hmm. is just a
kind of, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But Paul, you know, catches his senses again and everything, and, you know, finds his footing, and it's at this moment where, you know, he tosses his maker hooks out.
Well, yeah, let's talk about this one for a second. So we kind of cut to an aerial shot,
yep.
above him, and we get the ethereal music playing in the background, you know, the theme music, the all day cookie dough music. And have we made that joke? I'm sure we've made that joke.
I don't know if we made the joke.
I know we didn't write the joke, but I'm sure, I don't know if we've talked about it.
I don't know if it was a podcast episode or if that was just you and I.
Maybe so. Yeah, it sounds like they're singing all day cookie dough in this song. So that's all that I hear when I hear the song. So
I just call it the, you know, stereotypical Dune chanting theme, but sure. Yeah.
So we hear that music start to play, and I didn't know that these maker hooks are grappling hooks. We get some grapplers, dude.
Yeah.
So this is very different from the descriptions and like pictures or drawings that we get in the encyclopedia.
And also, I think the original.
Yeah, and other visuals, because
yeah,
maker hooks are described as being like long things.
Yeah, they're like two or more meter long. Like they're essentially ski poles with hooks on the ends.
I was gonna go like tall shepherd's poles. Shepherd sure. staffs. But yeah, just like very, very long things. So like the little climbing hooks, basically, that Paul is carrying struck me as a little odd when I first saw them.
Mm-hmm.
But at this point, they made sense.
So I'm going to interject with some Art and Soul notes.
Go for it.
Because in Art and Soul, all we saw was Liet Kynes with her maker hooks.
Right, right.
Just doing the initial deploy. They didn't really... Denis and co... didn't really have a complete idea of how the maker hooks were going to work back then. But prop master Doug Harlocker talks about how the maker hooks for part two were kind of reworked to include the deployable longer, grapple that can go up to 30 feet away from the rider.
Okay.
And I think the intention there, A, it looks really fucking cool.
Yeah.
But B, it gives that person, a little more leeway in terms of like being able to find spots of Shai Hulud that they can grab onto and control.
Yeah.
It's
cool. It's good.
But I think it was mostly for just the look of the riding and everything. Cause it's a really fucking cool, like
it is
shot.
I think the mechanics make sense in sure. universe. I mean, we talk all the time about internal consistencies, and I feel like that fits in great.
Well, it's internal consistencies, but it's also science fiction based in practical physical facts.
Yeah,
like a grapple hook like that is not something that you won't see now. Like
This is not Dune related, but I'm currently rewatching Star Trek Enterprise
for the
first time, actually. This was one that I avoided for a long time because I heard it was bad. It's not bad. I actually really enjoy it.
Okay.
But anyways, so the Enterprise, this one, the NX-01, does not have a tractor beam. This is before tractor beam technology was introduced to the Federation. They have grappling hooks on the ship.
Okay.
So whenever they want to pull something behind them or latch onto something, it's these two hooks that just shoot out from the ship and grab onto stuff.
So, okay. Question.
Okay.
We're not talking about Dune anymore. We're talking about Star Trek. This is now a Star Trek podcast from someone who has only occasionally watched episodes of TNG as they came on PBS as a kid or whatever.
Sure, sure.
Timeline-wise, is Enterprise before the original series then?
Oh, yeah, way before.
Okay. So like, canonically, Enterprise is the first series.
Yes.
Okay.
It's the first series. Yeah, depending on which episodes you want to look at, there are some that go back before. I mean, hell, Q takes Picard back to the Primordial Soup, so that's technically the first one. And then I think they, at one point, hide inside the Big Bang with a Q, but we don't have to talk about that.
Okay.
First Contact would be set before Enterprise.
Got it.
In the timeline. So, like, series-wise, it would go First Contact.
Enterprise.
Enterprise. And then I believe Strange New Worlds and Discovery are set a little bit before the original series.
Okay.
Yeah, because we're introduced to Kirk in Strange New Worlds. And then there's the original series. And then Next Gen after that.
Where does Deep Space Nine fall into all of this? Your favorite.
So Deep Space Nine, Voyager, and the end of TNG kind of all overlap. So the end of TNG and DS9 overlap, and then Voyager comes in about halfway through Deep Space Nine.
God, you're a fucking nerd.
I could be a little bit off on that. I think I'm right, though.
All right, well... Anyways.
Okay. Anyway, the point is, the NX-01 has grapplers, just like Paul's got grapplers.
This is no longer a Star Trek podcast.
Sorry for the detour. And so once he extends his hooks and he gets him into like a little, like one of the flaps, or what do we want to call those?
Flaps.
Flaps is good. Okay. Yeah. Once he gets them attached to one of the flaps, they're basically acting like reins on a horse at this point.
Yeah. And that's what, you know, and
it's good imagery.
Yeah.
It's really good imagery. It conveys that message and that point really, really well. I know we haven't really talked about it this movie, but we talked about it a lot last movie. With a, like, you know, show don't tell, because it would have cheapened it so much had before Paul walked up to the dune, Stilgar looked at him and went, now don't forget to extend your maker hook so you can steer the worm. No, I mean, yes, that would be not trusting your audience to figure it out.
Sure.
It's a show don't tell. It's great.
But also, like, I feel like most people know that when you're riding a horse, you know, you've got your reins and everything, so they can, you know, A to B, B to C, A to C, kind of, you know.
Yeah, it's good.
But yeah, we see Paul, like, really begin to take control by, you know, throwing his hooks out. He's, you know, steering the worm. And, you know, our music is all day cookie dough. We're big. We're loud. You know, we're celebrating because we immediately cut to Stilgar and Shishkali and Chani, along with the rest of the Fedaiken, as they celebrate Paul's, you know, riding of the worm. Paul is still in that low valley between all the dunes and everything. And
the Urg.
The Urg. And he's just kind of riding by everyone.
Yeah.
And we really like these, like, sidetracking shots in Dune Part 2, because we end with another one of these sidetracking shots of the desert as Paul's passing the group. And we end the minute with the Fedaiken all chanting Muad'Dib, Muad'Dib, Muad'Dib.
Right. Now, I had a question, and I don't have an answer to this, but I wanted to at least, like, see your thoughts or hear your thoughts. I don't want to see your thoughts.
That'd be a terrible sight for everyone.
I don't quite understand the placement of all of this. So Stilgar and them are watching Paul do this.
Yeah.
But we've already seen, like, from a aerial perspective, how small Paul is compared to the worm.
I feel like we need a whiteboard here to, like, lay out all of this, but carry on.
But I just, like, I didn't see anyone using binoculars or monoculars or whatever to, like, see him do this. And from their perspective, like, that must be so far away, because Paul's been on this worm for a good 20, 30 seconds at this point, if not more. And that worm is hauling ass across the desert. We see them burst through at least two dunes.
Sure.
So Paul's got to be a ways away from them. But yet they're watching it as if they can see it perfectly.
So I'm going to kick back to part one.
Okay.
Because at the very end of part one, what is our, you know, second to last shot of the movie, but not a Fremen riding a worm off in the distance. And Paul is able to point it out to Jessica, points out the Fremen riding, says, look, desert power.
Okay, the same question exists.
No, I understand that. What I'm saying is that you're seemingly able to determine that someone is standing on top of a worm because of the sudden, like, jarring shape on this very large object. But also, there is the wind kicking back all of the other outer garments beyond the stillsuit, making the appearance of the rider larger in that space as well.
Fair. I can buy that.
But also in this shot here, as Paul is, you know, passing the Fedaiken and everything, he's maybe 100 yards.
When he was 100. Okay. I would buy that he was a football field's worth of distance away.
He's at the end of this minute, as he's passing all of the Fedaiken on their ridge.
Yeah.
He's not that far from them. And also, like, Paul in part two, Paul is able to see Stilgar riding a worm just a few minutes ago.
Right. I don't know. I couldn't triangulate where people were, you know, I couldn't, like, picture it in my head.
So I think this Urg is kind of like in a bowl, right? Mm-hmm. It's surrounded by dunes on all sides. So Shai-Hulud. Oh God. All right. I'm going to try and describe this as best as I can for podcast.
Yeah, it's audio listeners. Format.
Yeah. So. Imagine a clock.
Okay.
Okay. At least from what I could tell from watching the movie. We're going to just use basic shapes and go from there.
Mm-hmm.
So top down, it's a clock. Stilgar and the rest of the Fedaiken are sitting at 6.
Okay.
Paul's on 3. The worm approaches from like 9 or 10.
Right. Right.
Cuts across the clock to 3.
Yep.
Goes out of the clock.
Mm-hmm.
Paul falls down. We see Paul turn the worm.
Yeah.
And kind of turn it back towards, like, in a very out and around, maybe, you know, we don't know exactly where, but we know that at the end of this sequence, Paul is going from left to right. So seemingly, Paul goes out 3, goes mm-hmm. out around the top of the clock, comes back through at, like, 9:10 again.
Right, right.
And, you know, goes back across the worm and back across the erg and is maybe, like, just...
doing circles.
Effectively doing donuts on the Shai Hulud.
That's awesome.
Yeah, he's doing donuts in the parking lot of a Wendy's at 3 a.m.
Hell yeah, dude. That's fucking sick. Okay. I mean, that has to be...
In my mind, that's what makes the most sense in terms of like where we see Paul traveling at the end of this minute
yeah.
and how we had seen the worm going earlier.
I agree. I agree with that. Okay, cool. I just wanted to bring that up because I was like, it feels like...
But also the Fedaiken would have known that, like, if Paul didn't have control, the worm would have just been going in a straight line and yeah. fucked off entirely.
Yeah, fair. I guess it was less so, like, could they even see him, but and more so, like, the positioning and the just how they shot it. I guess that was in question.
Yeah.
Okay, cool. All right, well, let us know. Dear listener, let us know what you think, because this is something that it never gets fully explained. But I would love to know if anyone has any thoughts on this particular, you know, minute of the movie.
Our minute ends with Muad'Dib, Muad'Dib, Muad'Dib.
Right, right.
Now, I have some art and soul notes and some behind the scenes extras notes.
Let's do it.
So, Tanya LaPointe, who is also the author of Art and Soul, was the unit director in charge of all things sandworm riding. In fact, her unit was called the Worm Unit.
Oh, hell yeah. I hope they got jackets made or something. That's so great.
I feel like there's always t-shirts or jackets or whatever for these kinds of things.
Absolutely. Could you imagine the Worm Unit patch on the sleeve? Oh.
That'd be the most badass fucking thing ever.
Yes. Oh, okay, anyways.
All of the R&D and shooting for this 1 3-minute scene took about 2 months.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So they did all of the, you know, development and filming from June 27th to August 27th of 2022 for 3 minutes of a movie. That's a lot of work.
Goodness gracious.
As we talked about yesterday, Denis wanted to make as much of this movie practical as possible. That includes all of the sand that hits the actors. So, in Budapest, which is where they shot all of the actual, like, on the worm sequences, they had just piles of sand matching all of the colors of the sand from the UAE and from Jordan out in those deserts. And what they would do is they would have these giant, like, you've seen them, industrial ass fans. Like, gone to a football game and you see those, like, huge fucking fans at either end of the team.
Yeah.
Yeah. They have those giant industrial fans with mortars in front of them, just packed full of dust and sand and shit. And those mortars would just, like, blow sand out into these fans, and they would just all, like, hit the actors square on right in the face. Fuck and everything. Yeah.
That's amazing. I love that.
Their first day of shooting, they entered the one-ton club, which was a ton of dust and sand just being blown out all over the place. They were saying in the extras and in Art and Soul that, like, these dust clouds in Budapest could be seen from miles away.
Damn.
So, like, it was very clear where they were filming this, you know, when all of this was going on. And what they would do is they built something called the dog collar, which is really more like a cone of shame than a collar.
Sure.
Where on the inside it was painted to match the same color as the desert in the UAE and Jordan.
Okay.
So that way when they're filming outside and the sunlight is reflecting onto the actors, it matches the color of the sunlight that would be reflecting onto those actors from the desert as well, therefore making VFX's life a little easier.
Now, how would they use that collar?
So the collar, basically on the middle of it, think of it like a dog, you know.
Yeah, cone, the cone.
Right, in the middle of it is where they would put the gimbal with the Shai Hulud skin.
Okay,
and got then
it. So this was a big fucking thing.
It's huge. I'm just gonna show you, because.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Got it. Like, yeah, that's really. I was picturing something the size of a. Like the dog, no scratching.
No.
Like, it's the same shape, though.
There's it's the same shape. It's just like whole ass trucks and shit in the middle of it.
Got it.
Huge.
Okay.
But yeah, they would have this gimbal and everything in the middle. They would, you know, do all the worm filming for the sequences where Paul, you know, was Christ on the cross.
Mm-hmm.
They had the worm skin 90 degrees from the ground.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Thankfully, you know, also being held with, you know, wires and everything.
Sure.
Safety first. But yeah, like, they would go absolutely nuts with,
that's wild,
you know, making sure that this is as practical as possible.
Yeah.
But yeah, just tons of dust and tons of, you know, sand being used in this lot to make it, you know, as real as they could, for a 2-month shooting schedule for 3 minutes of movie.
Well, like I said yesterday, the effort does not go unnoticed.
No, it does not. Now, I have some beefs.
Okay.
And it's a very obvious beef, I think, that you probably have as well.
We'll see.
We left last week with Paul running across the top of the sands.
Mm-hmm.
And his goggles were around his neck.
When did he put on his goggles and stuff?
When did he put on his goggles and also make sure that his goggles were under his turban?
Yeah, I noticed this. I didn't notate it down, but I definitely noticed it as I was watching. Yeah, that's continuity error.
Yeah. There.
Unless he did it while he was falling, but I'm not going to headcanon my way out of this.
No. Continuity error also wasn't Timothée Chalamet, so they had to hide his face as much as possible.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good call out.
But yeah, the worm unit was in charge of all of these shots, and they were in charge of all of the worm shots, so the ones that we'll see later on in the movie as well.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be back to talk a little more about those when we get to those minutes.
God, I want a worm unit jacket so bad. It sounds so awesome.
But that's all I have for Art and Soul Notes for today. We have a couple more to talk about tomorrow. So,
all right, cool. Well, if you want to get in touch with us, we are on bluesky@duneminute.com. We have an email address, and that is duneminute@gmail.com. Reach out, give us your thoughts on the shooting perspective of the movie. And also, if you want to never hear about Star Trek again on the Dune podcast, that's fine too. Let me know. If you want to hear more about it, I got a lot to say.
That was my fault. I opened a can of worms by letting Zach talk about Star Trek. So, my bad.
All right, cool. We'll be back tomorrow for another episode of the Dune Minute podcast. See ya.